Evolutionary Psychology, Part 1, The Science of Human Nature, Lecture 12, Attraction, Courtship, and Mating.
Recall that in the previous lecture on the evolution of human sexuality, we learned that female and male reproductive success can be maximized by several different mechanisms. Male reproductive success is almost entirely a function of two factors: how many females a male can mate with, and how many offspring those females can successfully raise. This is why most evolutionary psychologists predict that most males will be motivated to mate with as many different females as possible, all other things being equal. Males that do not do this generally have fewer offspring, and given enough time, they will be replaced in populations, leaving only males that maximize the number of females with whom they mate. Female reproductive success is much more tightly circumscribed. Rather than simply maximizing the number of offspring that they produce, females that optimize their reproductive efforts generally have the highest relative reproductive success. In other words, since females can only produce a limited number of offspring during their lifetime, mating with many males will not necessarily increase this number. However, mating with several different males often results in increased reproductive success relative to mating with just one. Recall as well that males and females differ in what qualities sexual selection would most likely have biased them to prefer. These biases can be stated as hypotheses, which can then be tested empirically to see if the theories upon which they've been formulated are valid. For example, as Donald Simons pointed out in The Evolution of Human Sexuality, males should be attracted to younger females that have physical features that indicate that they are healthy, because these trends are indicators of higher potential female reproductive success. Females, on the other hand, should be attracted to older males that have behavioral and physical cues that suggest that they will be able to provide resources and, ideally, quality child care to the limited number of babies that females can produce. Notice that these predispositions on the parts of females and males are complementary. Older males prefer younger females, and vice versa. Notice also that this means that two classes of people, younger males and older females, are predicted to fare less well in the competition to produce viable offspring. Of these two categories, younger males have better prospects, as they will eventually mature and command more resources, and perhaps along the way learn how to be more solicitous parents. Older females, however, are not entirely out of options. If they have already successfully raised children, they can still assist their children in raising their grandchildren, thereby increasing their overall reproductive success. However, females that reach the age of menopause without reproducing in general become invisible to selection. From an evolutionary standpoint, it is as if they never existed. Therefore, those females that, to use a common phrase, hear the reproductive clock ticking, and especially for those whom its ticking grows louder with age, are selected for over those who don't hear the clock ticking at all, or, for whatever reason, ignore it. Over the past few decades, evolutionary psychologists have conducted considerable research to determine if these predictions are valid and what kinds of sensory, cognitive, and behavioral patterns are correlated with increased relative reproductive success. In particular, considerable research has been conducted into precisely what characteristics females and males find most attractive. That is, which cues provide the most reliable information about reproductive quality. Most of these studies have been specifically focused on attractiveness, that is, on those anatomical and behavioral characteristics that result in the highest intensity courtship behaviors and, ideally, the highest relative reproductive success. Donald Simons pointed out that the sexual desires and dispositions that were adaptive for either sex were for the other sex tickets to reproductive oblivion. This is particularly true for attractiveness. Females and males differ significantly in their primary and secondary sex characteristics. these differences are correlated with different behavioral and physiological adaptations. Since females and males are predicted to cue in on different qualities in a prospective mate, it is likely that the anatomical, behavioral, and physiological cues that they consider to be most attractive will be different as well. David Buss, one of the founders of the science of evolutionary psychology and a leader in research into human mating preferences, has summarized the characteristics that females should find most attractive, given the predictions discussed earlier. These are cues indicating a male's ability to invest in raising offspring. These include such things as age, ambition, control of resources, industriousness, social status, strength, and so forth. Cues indicating a male's willingness to invest in raising offspring. These include such things as behavioral cues indicating affection, commitment, dependability, stability, and, of course, positive interactions with children. Cues indicating a male's ability to protect his mate and offspring. These include such things as age, courage, dexterity, health, physical strength, and size, especially, once again, height. Cues indicating a male's ability to care for his offspring. These include such things as dependability, emotional stability, kindness, and once again, positive interactions with children. Cues indicating a male's compatibility as a mate. These include such things as familiar ages, similar personalities, and similar values. And finally, cues indicating a male's overall health and longevity. These include such things as age and physical condition, clear skin, dexterity, gait as an indicator of locomotor health, and symmetry, especially facial symmetry. There is abundant natural history evidence that females in other species choose their mates on the basis of this list of cues. This is particularly true for females in polygynous species, as they generally cannot rely as much on the undivided attention of a successful male mate. Female mate choice has long been known to be correlated with such exaggerated male characteristics as long tails and bright plumage in birds, indicators of better nutrition and lower parasite loads, as well as indicators that females in previous generations have found such males to be desirable mates. Things like larger antlers and horns in deer and ungulates, indicators of older age, better nutrition, lower parasite loads, and successful defense against predators and rival males, and of course body size and strength in almost all vertebrates. Although the situation is more complex for humans, the same general trends are noticeable. Territory size and command of resources are correlated with polygyny in humans, indicating that more women are willing to mate with men who command more of such resources. However, since men in polygynous societies must spread their attention and resources over more women and children, many women, including many in societies that allow polygyny, choose to invest in males who demonstrate an ability and willingness to invest exclusively in their offspring. The flip side of this is that if men, and especially men with single female mates, perceive that their children are not actually theirs genetically, they are much more likely to either abandon or ignore them, or even harm or kill them under certain circumstances. Some women pursue an alternative covert strategy. Choosing men that don't necessarily invest much in their children, but show clear signs of being reproductively successful nevertheless. The assumption is that if she can successfully raise such children, her sons from such a male could inherit his characteristics, a hypothesis sometimes called the sexy son hypothesis. Indeed, the ideal reproductive strategy for a woman, although it's very difficult to pursue, is to convince a good provider to care for her children, a stable, powerful, resource-based male, while having the children actually be fathered by a producer of sexy sons. This also means that men who can demonstrate that multiple women have found them attractive are more likely to attract even more women. Up to a point, of course. Hence, the common advertising strategy of showing a single handsome man surrounded by multiple attractive young women. Check the next TV ad or billboard. You'll find it's true. More important than any other single cue for women compared with men is the economic and financial status of men. In all studies of all cultures, regardless of whether the official mating system is monogamy or polygamy, women rate economic and financial status significantly higher than men do. David Buss has summarized the findings of the largest study conducted on this subject. Women worldwide desire financial resources and a marriage partner much more than men do. Women also consistently rate social status higher than men do, and in general, rate older men more attractive than men their own age or especially younger. This is because, on the average, the older a man is, up to a point, the greater his wealth, prestige, and social status, not to mention experience and intelligence. However, women generally do not find very old men attractive, as their probability of surviving long enough to raise their offspring is lower, unless such men are extremely wealthy and the women can be reasonably certain of inheriting their money if they die. Last but not least, among the cues indicating ability to provide resources is ambition and industriousness. And once again, women rate these characteristics significantly higher than men do. Although women rate these characteristics much higher than men do, the traits that they rate the highest of all in a potential mate are love, kindness, dependability, and emotional stability. Interestingly, women also rate the tendency for men to express sexual jealousy very, very low, near the bottom of their list of preferences. These cues correlate highly with personal satisfaction on the part of females, and also with male suitability as parents. Women also find men who are attentive and kind with children more attractive than men who are indifferent or hostile to children. Finally, although women do not rate physical characteristics as high as men do, they do show a significant preference for men who are taller, physically fit, and athletic. This preference is suspected of being at least a partial holdover from our Pleistocene past, in which such men could provide protection to women and their children, as well as being better hunters and workers. It is also significant to note that these characteristics are also positively correlated with the other cues that women use to rate potential mates, combining to produce a mutually reinforcing suite of male characters that are strongly correlated with reproductive success, and therefore with female choice. One more cue has drawn much attention lately in the popular press: facial and body symmetry. There is indirect evidence from developmental medicine that facial and body symmetry are positively correlated with general overall health. In particular, facial and body asymmetry are indirect indicators of genetic abnormalities, while symmetry is associated with a higher degree of general health, especially during childhood. Demographic studies have confirmed that the preferences shown by women for potential male mates do indeed translate to higher rates of marriage. For example, women's responses to personal ads correspond very closely to the cues identified in surveys of preferences, such as those described above. Sociological studies also indicate that physically attractive women more often marry men with higher financial and social status. However, these are only indirect confirmations of the predictions that flow from the preferences listed earlier. It isn't clear from the foregoing that the preferences listed actually translate into higher relative reproductive success of women and men. To see if this is the case, let's look at the characteristics that men use to choose their female mates. Consider what reproductive success means for a female versus what it means for a male. Female reproductive success means getting a male to impregnate you, and then, if necessary, getting a male to provide enough resources for your offspring to survive until they reproduce. As should be pretty clear by now, the first part, getting a male to impregnate you, is usually not difficult for most females. The second part depends primarily on how abundant resources are in your local environment. If they're abundant, then as a female, your reproductive success is not dependent on your mate's behavior, as it might be in a poorer environment. This means that females who base their choice of male mates on their ability to provide resources for their offspring have the highest relative reproductive success. For a male, reproductive success means getting a female to let you impregnate her, and then, if necessary, providing enough resources for your offspring to survive until they reproduce. As should also be clear by now, the first part, getting a female to let you impregnate her, is the ultimate key to male reproductive success. But which female should a male be most interested in? The answer should be obvious. Males who can get a young, healthy, and therefore probably fertile female to mate with them will have a higher reproductive success than males who either can't get such females to mate with them or who mate with older or less healthy females. Males that fulfill the criteria that females use to choose mates will have higher reproductive success than males that do not, and vice versa. Males that command sufficient resources to help a female successfully raise her offspring, and who demonstrate through their behavior that they are willing and able to provide such resources, will be chosen most often by females, and females that demonstrate through their behavior and appearance that they're fertile and have the potential of producing many offspring will be preferred most often by males. When surveyed concerning the criteria that they use to rate a potential mate, men rate youth and physical appearance much higher than women do. Both men and women rate attentiveness, affection, kindness, and love highest when seeking a mate. However, from an evolutionary standpoint, we're most interested in those characteristics in which there are significant differences. That is, sufficient variation to provide the raw material for natural and sexual selection. For men, youth and appearance are the most important such variables affecting mate choice. In cultures in which monogamy is the social norm, there is a significant age difference between men and women at first marriage, with men averaging around 3 years older than their first wife. As our evolutionary analysis predicts, this age difference is significantly greater in polygynous cultures, with men averaging more than 5 years older than their first and subsequent wives. And as the pilot study cited in the previous lecture indicates, this pattern holds for cultures in which serial monogamy, that is, vertical polygamy, is the rule. Men, on the average, are 3 years older than their first wife, 5 years older than their second, 8 years older than the third, and so forth. The age gap widens with each subsequent marriage. The data on actual reproductive success also supports this trend. Men who marry younger women have significantly more children, that is, a higher reproductive success than men who marry older women. And finally, the situation is the opposite for women. Those who marry older men have higher reproductive success than those who marry very young men, especially in cultures in which male assistance is a requirement for successful child rearing. Another testable prediction is that men should prefer to mate with women who are not already mated with other men, and especially those who have not already had children with other men, and in particular, those who are not pregnant by other men. Again, demographic data support this prediction. Men are much more likely to marry women who have not yet married or had children by other men. This means that the extraordinarily high value placed on virginity in some cultures makes evolutionary sense. In cultures in which paternity is not easily determined, men strongly prefer to mate with women who have not yet had sex with any other man, and therefore cannot yet have had or be carrying children fathered by any other man. Conversely, this means that women should prefer to mate with men who have already demonstrated that they're both fertile and willing and able to father children. That is, men who have already had children and, if possible, raised them successfully. Besides virginity, what other cues can a man use to maximize his relative reproductive success when seeking a mate? If there are anatomical characteristics that are correlated with future fertility, males who cued into such characteristics when pursuing a mate would have a higher probability of increased reproductive success. Two such characteristics have been identified and studied, both of which are ultimately biologically determined: waist-to-hip ratio and feminized facial structure. Prior to puberty, both boys and girls have approximately identical waist-to-hip ratios, about 0.85 to 0.95. That is, their waists and hips are about the same diameter. However, during puberty, female sex hormones, especially estrogen, cause more fat to be deposited on the hips and also cause the bones underlying the hips to change shape, thereby reducing the female waist-to-hip ratio. Studies conducted on men in many cultures have shown that men find a waist-to-hip ratio of about 0.7 to be maximally attractive, with lower waist-to-hip ratios rated as less attractive. Epidemiological studies have shown that female reproductive success is also correlated with reduced waist-to-hip ratio, peaking once again at about 0.7. An interesting discovery in this regard is that American women rate even lower waist-to-hip ratios as attractive than men do, indicating a tendency among most women to overshoot the ideal waist-to-hip ratio. Elevated estrogen levels in women are also correlated with characteristic changes in the shape of the face. The jawline is less pronounced, the distance from nose to chin is slightly less, and the ratio of the size of the eyes to the overall size of the face is larger. All of these characteristics are correlated with higher ratings of attractiveness by men. Using computer morphing techniques, female photographs can be manipulated to produce different feminine and masculine ratios in facial structure. Men rate the most feminized faces highest, indicating an indirect preference for higher estrogen levels, while females rate masculinized faces somewhat higher, indicating an indirect preference for higher testosterone levels. Elevated estrogen and testosterone levels are correlated with higher reproductive success, thereby supporting the hypothesis that males and females are using such cues as indirect measures of potential reproductive success. There are many other similar correlations that we could explore, but I would like to turn now to what happens after someone has picked out a potential mate. What happens next? Well, consider the potential dangers of choosing the wrong mate. Not only might they have lower actual reproductive success, but the process of mating itself can expose one to real threats. The possibility of wasting precious resources, the possibility of contracting a sexually transmitted disease, and the possibility of physical and/or emotional abuse are all potential dangers that accompany the pursuit of a mating partner. Indeed, physical contact of any kind with another human carries with it a non-zero possibility of such dangers. We observe that all animals, including humans, generally maintain what is referred to as an individual distance from other animals, that is, a cushion of space that they generally will not allow to be penetrated by another individual. Mating, however, involves copulation, and copulation requires elimination of this protective cushion of distance and non-touching. Is there something that can overcome our evolved reticence at being physically touched by others? In 1979, Deborah Tinov published Love and Limerence, in which she identified a condition called limerence, a specific behavioral pattern with consistent physiological effects that is correlated with the early stages of courtship and mating in humans. Limerence is a behavioral adaptation that results in the breakdown of behavioral inhibitions and individual distance, leading generally to mating and copulation. Limerence is correlated with profound neurochemical changes in the nervous system, including physiological, cognitive, and behavioral changes that increase the probability of mating and especially copulation. Tinov, a psychotherapist and professor of psychology, discovered limerence by accident, observing that a significant number of her patients showed a similar pattern of behavior and cognition while falling in love. Central to the concept of limerence is the limerent object, the person upon whom one's limerence is focused. Tinov cataloged the following primary symptoms of limerence: overall emotional and psychological arousal with altered appetite, cognition, and sleep patterns. Intrusive thinking about the limerent object, especially when such thinking overshadows other thoughts and activities. Acute longing for reciprocation by the limerent object, combined with acute sensitivity to any hint of such reciprocation. Acute anxiety when uncertain about the feelings of the limerent object, often accompanied by intense shyness and confusion in the presence of the limerent object. A physical aching in the chest or stomach when uncertainty about the limerent object's feelings is strong. And buoyancy and intense joy if the limerent object is perceived as reciprocating, even if this perception is false. A strong tendency to emphasize the positive qualities and minimize the negative qualities of the limerent object. Overall, limerence is characterized by extreme emotional lability, with abrupt mood swings from high to low and back, depending on relatively minor changes in perceived reciprocation by one's limerent object. Tinov also noted that if limerence is reciprocated, it generally decays over time, eventually disappearing within 2 to 4 years. If limerence is not reciprocated, this time course may be lengthened, and if a mutually limerent couple is prevented from consummating their relationship, the intensity of limerence typically increases as well. Reciprocated limerence virtually always involves sexual behavior, and especially copulation. In general, however, the higher the frequency of copulation, the more rapid the decay of limerence. Tinov suggested that limerence is an evolutionary adaptation that has the effect of increasing the likelihood of mating between mutually limerent individuals. However, Tinov did not test this hypothesis herself. Limerence is essentially a state of heightened physiological arousal. An interesting question is, does it matter what causes this heightened physiological arousal? In 1974, Donald Dutton and Arthur Aaron conducted a study into the effects of physiological arousal on sexual attraction. They set up a deceptively simple experiment. A female Confederate presented a brief survey to male students in one of two locations, both of them on the campus of the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. At the center of a narrow, rickety suspension bridge crossing a deep ravine, and at the center of a wide, solid concrete bridge over a shallow stream. They then asked the male students to write a brief passage describing the female who presented the survey. They found that despite the fact that it was the same female in the same clothing presenting the same survey in both locations, the males who had met the female Confederate on the rickety bridge used significantly more sexually charged imagery than the males who met the Confederate on the low concrete bridge. They concluded that the heightened physiological arousal caused by being on the rickety bridge was unconsciously interpreted by the men as a state of sexual arousal, which affected their assessment of the attractiveness of the female Confederate. This outcome suggested that physiological responses, specifically activation of the sympathetic nervous and hormonal systems, plays an important role in mediating sexual attractiveness and preparation for mating. More recently, Helen Fisher and her colleagues have studied the neurochemistry of courtship and mating and have identified three distinct types of love, each with different biological functions, which they refer to as lust, romantic love, and attachment. In their model of attraction, courtship, and mating, lust is approximately equivalent to attraction, especially sexual attraction. Lust, in other words, is a state of sexual arousal triggered by the cues discussed earlier and focused on a particular individual. Romantic love corresponds with and has most of the symptoms of limerence as defined by Tinov. An attachment is generally unlike either lust or romantic love in that attached individuals become calmer and happier when in each other's physical presence rather than emotionally and psychologically aroused. However, attachment is highly correlated with anxiety following separation from the person to which one has become attached, to a degree that is greater than on either lust or romantic love. Fisher and her colleagues have used functional magnetic resonance imaging, often called fMRI technology, to determine if specific brain regions are associated with the three different kinds of love. They have also looked for correlations between these types of love and changes in the concentrations of brain chemicals, called neurotransmitters, that transmit and modify messages in the nervous system. In both cases, they've been successful, finding clear correlations between brain activity, neurochemistry, and the behaviors and emotions described here. Furthermore, there are distinct gender-related differences in these patterns. Females react with different parts of their brains than men do when falling in love. All three kinds of love are associated with nervous pathways in the brain that use specific chemical messengers. Lust involves elevated levels of the male hormone testosterone. Indeed, sex drive is almost entirely mediated by testosterone in both males and females. Romantic love is associated with elevated levels of dopamine, a mood-altering neurotransmitter also associated with the high of cocaine use. Attachment is associated with elevated levels of two hormones, oxytocin and vasopressin, also secreted by brain cells. Finding specific areas in the brain that are associated with the three different kinds of love, and especially correlating those brain centers with specific neurotransmitters, is strong evidence that these three behavioral and emotional states are evolutionary adaptations. The construction and operation of anatomical and physiological adaptations such as these is directed ultimately by genes, the existence of which is ultimately the result of natural and sexual selection. Like the other behavioral adaptations we have discussed so far, the context within which one expresses these genes varies from culture to culture. However, as we have seen, there are some characteristics that are found in virtually all cultures, which is again a strong argument that they are evolutionary adaptations. Since natural and sexual selection both ultimately depend on differential reproductive success, it should not be surprising that those human behaviors associated with courtship and mating are the result of the expression of evolved psychological mechanisms. However, successful reproduction doesn't end with mating. Most vertebrates, especially vertebrates on land, provide some form of parental care, which increases the probability of survival of offspring. This is particularly the case for mammals, which have specialized anatomical, physiological, and behavioral adaptations for providing parental care. And among mammals, primates are noted for providing parental care for an unusually long percentage of the lifespan. In the last two lectures in this series, we will take a look at some of the evolutionary adaptations associated with child rearing and parental care. we will see that after the first flush of limerence burns out, another kind of love, attachment, cements us to our mates, and later, to our children. We will also learn how the same underlying biological processes of attachment are involved with this long-term form of love between parents and children. But we will also find out that, like other long-term partnerships, the relationships between parents and offspring often involves conflicts that can have surprising long-term effects on the development of animals, and especially humans and human families.
This ends Lecture 12. Remember to visit this course's website at www.modernscholar.com, where you'll find additional information about the lectures you just heard. If you borrowed this course from a public library and would like your own copy of the course guide for future reference, call Recorded Books at 1-800-636-3399, and we'll send you a free copy. A shipping charge will apply.